G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. How are you today?
Going great.
That's good.
How's your backyard looking?
That's good. It's looking better, thank you. It's looking safer.
Safer?
It's looking safer, yes. Yes, there's one significant tree that's no longer there.
Did you wear a vest? Did you have to wear a vest yesterday? High-vis, OH&S vest when you're out there just patrolling and guiding the lopping of the tree?
I didn't get too close. I'll give you the tip. That's quite a skilled operation, that sort of thing. We've had a tree that was very close to the house and we were worried about it falling down and crushing either the house, which it's almost done previously, or a person, and just seeing the branches come down in a controlled manner, just even a branch, the velocity of which it hits the ground, quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary to see how it all unfolds.
Did you picture yourself climbing the tree at any stage?
Absolutely no chance. Absolutely no chance. All I kept thinking about was whether Dame Wash-a-Lot, Moonface, Mr. What's-His-Name, may come out of the tree at some point.
What about Fanny?
But anyway. No, but they climbed it. No, I'm talking about more
right. the ones who lived in the tree.
The ones that lived in the tree. Because it was that big. Anyway, it's no longer. Lots of firewood now.
Oh, well played. Yeah, that's the bonus. Not only is there a chance that you'll stay alive a bit longer, but you get lots more firewood to stay warm when you're alive.
Exactly right. Exactly
right.
That's
a great result.
So they're back today.
Well done. Well done.
So if anyone hears any sort of loud noise over the next couple of hours, because, of course, we're still doing the program from home, that's what's going on.
Righto.
Yeah.
We'll pay attention to that.
There's some really interesting things to talk about early. Which sport? Choose a sport.
Golf.
Okay, we'll start with golf. This is for $25 and a pick of the board. Which big-name golfer has withdrawn from next week's US Open?
Brooks Koepka.
Correct. So this is quite a big story.
Hang on, I've got a pick of the board. I'll take Bert Newton, thanks.
Bert Newton. Congratulations, you won the Tosca Small Goods.
Small Goods? Leather Goods.
Leather Goods.
I didn't know Tosca were making Small Goods. Well, they got to get your leather from somewhere, I suppose.
I was going to say, if you leave the Tosca Small Goods out long enough, they will become Small Goods. Or probably the other way around. Anyway.
I know what you meant.
Yeah.
Yes, Brooks is out.
So this is quite significant because he's had a knee problem for quite some time and he just can't get it right. Now, he's saying he's close to 100% but not good enough to be able to play. But considering how he's been a dominant player for quite some time now, if you look at the last 12 months or so, he has missed a fair bit of golf because of this knee problem. So that is a big blow. To the US Open to have, he's not number one in the world anymore, but if you look at the amount of major championships he's won over the last 3 years, he's a huge name that's not going to be participating next week. So while the PGA Tour has finished for the year, we actually start again this week with the Safeway Open to start the new season. So we have got the US Open next week and he's not going to be participating. So, yeah, I thought that was an interesting story.
Well,
but there's another interesting story.
You can rule out two because Rory can't win. So there's Brooks and Rory who can't win.
No, that's right. Oh, that's a bit harsh.
Rory can't win. He can't win.
Well, if the conditions are benign or if the course is wet, that's when he does win the US Open or a PGA Championship.
He's going to be required to make a 6-foot putt somewhere.
Oh,
that's not his strength. It's not his strength for a Rory.
No,
he just can't putt.
No, he can't. So there was that. But the other interesting thing that's happening in the world of golf is that when we get to November, we are going to have the US Masters.
Yes.
And this year in the US Masters on Saturday and Sunday, because of course it's being played at a very different time of the year, on Saturday and Sunday, they are going to be playing the final two rounds earlier, so that it doesn't clash with college football on the Saturday and the NFL on the Sunday. So, yeah, I thought that was quite interesting.
That would be a broadcast request, would it not? That wouldn't be a Augusta National request. And probably the first time in history that Augusta National has bowed to any level of pressure from anyone. They run their own shop and are very firm in doing so. So it is a significant concession, I think, from Augusta National because of what's happened and the time zone that they find themselves playing in. Yeah, my ears pricked up on that when I heard that yesterday as well, that they finally conceded something, Augusta National. They're not the kings of the world anymore.
Yeah, well, certainly at that time of year. And I think, you know, it would be a very... Well, there has the potential to be a very similar situation if there was a clash here with, say, golf and AFL or something, or golf and NRL. You just, you know, there is the potential that they would have to make an adjustment. But we know that the golf tournament is going to be very different anyway because of the difference of, you know, having it, rather than having it in a late spring situation. They're having it in a late autumn situation. So, you know, the trees are going to be different. I doubt the azaleas would be out in bloom. The grasses will be different. But the other thing about the US Masters, which makes it such an attractive event to watch on television, or be there, as you have, is that that late afternoon, the shadows and all that sort of thing, you know, and if it goes to a playoff situation, potentially it being played almost in darkness.
Dark.
All those sorts of things, that gets taken away. So, I thought that was an interesting story to talk about this morning.
Oh, I think you're right. Oh, I think absolutely. Augusta National conceding to other sport, or deferring to other sports, is a big, big announcement in the world of sport because they don't do anything on anyone else's terms. It's an unusual setup.
Yeah, interesting. Exactly.
Before we move on to another sport, let's get to John on the road who wants to open a batting in another topic. Hello, John.
There you go, Phyllis. Just be honest with me, do you reckon it's a big waste of time getting that Irish dude back? And do you reckon there's lack of discipline at the Essendon Football Club, mate? But we call ourselves the Bombers, really. So disappointed, mate. 20 years since the flag. I think they've got to get hard and just get rid of a few players. And then he wants to play up forward. Who's running the show? We've got two coaches and you've got a player telling you where he wants to play. And then he's gone. The start of the year, I said, get rid of him. I'm just baffled by this club. They've got to get harder, mate. Otherwise, we're going to be nothing for another 10 years.
So I assume you're talking about Conor McKenna, John, and his decision to retire?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I don't think he'll be coming back, certainly to the Bombers. I wouldn't think if he's chosen to walk away and go back home, and that's his right. If he's not comfortable, he's not happy, he's entitled to do that, but I don't think he'd be coming back to the Bombers at any stage. What if that's the decision he's made on this occasion?
No, I wouldn't have thought so, although he did say at another point that he wouldn't come back, and he did come back. But I think, John, in the case of Conor McKenna, I mean, this is always a unique situation when you've got someone that, you know, his life is on the other side of the world, and he came across to have a crack at it, and, you know, he did play some breathtaking football at times, clearly as a running defender, not as a forward. But I think he was good enough that he was a very popular member of the team there at times, that you have to be in a situation where you squeeze the lemon enough to try and get the best out of him and give him the best chance to succeed. And clearly, him coming back this year, it didn't work. But this year, again, the environment is so different to what we've had in the past. And I don't think he ever really recovered also, John, for the story coming out that he had tested positive to coronavirus and all the fanfare and the scrutiny that went on under that. I think that took a lot out of him as well. So I think there's a fair bit going on with Connor. And I think the answer to your other question about Essendon not being ruthless, I mean, that's the perception at the moment, both on and off the field. You know, I think that this is the problem that Essendon have got now, is that because there has been now 20 years since premierships at Bomberland, and when they won them through the 80s, 90s, and again that very early 2000 premiership, it was sort of one of the foundation stones to their success was the ruthlessness with the way that they played, and at times the way they were off the field. And when that's not the foundation stone to your to any sort of perceived success at the moment, half, you're going to naturally go back to when you were successful and what the foundation stones were. And I think that's the big challenge now for the football club, because you're going to get some impatient people from the past, and are going to go, well, we need to be what we were when we were successful.
But you know this as well as anyone. You talk about this a lot. And thank you, John, for your call. That if it's manufactured and it's not authentic, then it's
absolutely
just fluff and wind anyway. So
exactly,
there's no point going back to where you were if that's not who you are anymore. Like if that's not your
that's
list
exactly
or your
right.
squad or your club, don't make it up, because it's not going to work for you anyway.
That is exactly right. And if you go through the AFL, who would be the tough team of the competition?
I don't know.
The ones that you fear playing.
I don't think there'd be too many that you'd fear playing from an intimidation perspective, would there? Just going
exactly.
through the teams in my head. There's not too many. The game's a bit different now, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, probably the last team that you would put into that category was the Unsociable Hawks.
Yep.
And they were one half that were able to change their perception, because through your period and probably a little bit after that period, they were seen as being a bit soft and a bit sort of party boy, sort of friendly, all hug and all that sort of stuff all the time.
Sure, there was too much hugging going on, but I know.
Well, when you won and you'd all arm in arm and sort of run off the walk off the field and sing the song and all that sort of stuff.
Well, we didn't win very often,
mate.
You have to celebrate.
At the time. Yeah, but my point is that when they actually brought players in that had the harder edge, and that was always, you know, that line in the sand game sort of started a bit of that, and they had an edge to them. Hawthorn always played its best when it played on the edge, and they were feared a little bit for the way that they went about things. You know, North Melbourne under Dennis Pagan had that edge about them with the likes of Archer and Pickett and these sorts of players that played for them. Clearly Essendon, whether it was 2000 with Solomon and Hardwick and Johnson and these types, but then further back clearly in the 80s with Duckworth and etc. Successful teams often had that edge. But I think when you look at it now, it's all about the discipline of running patterns and formations and defensive zones and all that sort of stuff. Other teams that seem to be successful and the discipline to be able to have a plan that works. So I think football's very different to back when Essendon was last successful, which the reality is 20 years ago.
Off the SMS from Camo, Essendon just like all my life, just not up to the grade. Now, Camo, I've never banned anyone off the SMS, but you're about to get one. You're about to cop one right between the eyes, Camo. I'm not accepting that. All my life will be back. She'll be back. Just needs a bit further, maybe 1,200, maybe even 14 to the end. Maybe some blinkers. We'll be right, Camo. We'll sort it out. Good barrier.
But I think the last thing from... I'll say on the Essendon situation for the time being is that I think Johnny's emblematic of a lot of Essendon fans out there that have had a gutful, and the patience has worn thin and they're getting really, really agitated. And I think there are quite a few influential Essendon people and former players, as we saw during the week with Dean Wallace, that have had a gutful. And it'll be fascinating to see what happens as a result of that.
Well, poor old Bombers. Poor old Bombers.
Pick another spot, please.
Cricket.
Okay, cricket. A couple of interesting things to talk about here, Denny. We haven't had a chance to talk about this week. By the way, congratulations, you won the patch of orange juice. This is probably more a World of Sport thing than a Sale
that's,
of the Century. You should have probably won like a trip to Tahiti or something like that. But anyway, Yuvraj Singh wants to come out and play in the Big Bash.
He does.
Now, he's quite old, Yuvraj.
He's about 107, isn't he?
But he wants to be kind of like the first Indian to come out and be part of it all. Now, at this stage, there doesn't seem to be a lot of takers. But I think this is potentially a really significant thing in the sense of to get the Indian interest in the Big Bash in regards to television. But also just, you know, the Indian community. We know how many people love their cricket that live out here just when India plays here. I think it's something that the Big Bash need to do whatever it takes to get these guys involved. Now, the IPL has meant that that's been virtually impossible in the past, and the BCCI don't like the idea of Indians coming out and playing. But whether it's Dhoni or whether it's potentially Yuvraj Singh, it would add a very interesting layer when the perception of the BBL is that it's gone a bit stale.
Yes, well, imagine if you could get Dhoni. Now, Yuvraj was a fantastic player in his heyday. Now, as you say, he's perhaps a little bit long in the tooth to be paying big marquee
dollars. He'd still be okay.
He's more than capable cricketer. But imagine if you can get MS Dhoni, Mahendra Singh Dhoni, in the colours of one of the Australian Big Bash teams. That'd be unbelievable on so many fronts. I'm sure there's a phone calls being made at the moment trying to get him out of wherever he is and get him to Australia for the Big Bash. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think it could be potentially a game changer for the Big Bash, although because of the situation, don't we always find that, that as you said, the IPL takes precedent over these things and the timing doesn't work? And with Test cricket and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think it's more that. I mean, there's a number of reasons. I mean, the IPL is usually held in sort of April and May. The Big Bash clearly not in that area, but there's always a competing league that's going on. You know, ever since the Pakistan Super League got involved, and there's another one in the UAE. Like, there's so many of them now that the Big Bash is competing with other leagues and other international stars. I'd be surprised if the Melbourne Stars haven't already tried to at least look at the option with MS Dhoni. But, yeah, again, it's going to be difficult. But we saw the interest in AB de Villiers playing some games for the Brisbane Heat. It clearly is worth a crack at trying to get these sorts of players. I think everyone thought it was unrealistic initially that de Villiers would come, but he did. And, you know, I think that's what the Big Bash and Cricket Australia need to be working together with to make sure that they're given the best possible chance of that. So I thought that was an interesting story. And just whether that becomes, you know, if he does come over, whether that becomes the start of a few other of the Indian players getting involved in it.
That would be nice. That would be nice. What other sport have I got for you? What else has played around the world? Basketball. Got any basketball news for me?
No.
Right.
So, no. Try the world game.
Soccer.
Good choice, Daniel. Very good choice. You've won the mower that comes with a catcher.
I need to get my blades sharpened. That's what I need to get, my blades sharpened on my mower.
Oh, you're going to have to wait till November for that,
I think. No, it's disappointing. I need some sharpening.
Talking of which, can you believe that you can't get a haircut until late October?
Well, it's not a problem I'm too concerned about, I must admit.
Well, it's a major problem for me because I haven't had a haircut since that disaster of Cindy. That's still an issue. It's okay. I'll be able to get that fixed soon enough because I'm going to get reshaped. Well, I haven't. The legacy of Cindy lives on.
I haven't actually seen your hair since that moment. You've worn a hat every day. Now, you work inside your house
100%.
In your study. And you make an effort to put a hat on every morning, even though it's radio.
Absolutely.
Just so I don't have to see your hair.
It's like a Molly Meldrum situation with a cowboy hat. I hope Cindy... Now, I don't mean this disrespectfully for everyone out there. But I hope Cindy's taking this time to reflect. She can't cut hair at the moment. I hope she's taking this time to reflect. Anyway, I digress. So, in the world of football, two things. There has been a leaked report that's come out that Lionel Messi was actually hunted down by Manchester City, but because of that that sort of transfer fee that was involved in all of that, it was the reason why that couldn't go through, which has meant that Messi stays at Barcelona, which we talked about. But the other thing that's just emerged in the last 24 hours is that the proposed bid to take over Newcastle United by that Middle Eastern organisation.
Was it the Saudi organisation? Yep.
I think so. We'll just put it in the Middle Eastern sort of zone just to so we can cover all bases. The US have Middle Eastern interests. But that situation with Newcastle has fallen through. So that's going to leave a lot of Newcastle fans really flat, because with that potential takeover came a lot of money and the thought of, you know, them becoming a real power again. So that's just happened recently. Now, some people at Newcastle are blaming the FFA for not sort of participating appropriately to make sure that deal was done.
Now,
and
that's not fair.
All these sorts of things.
Absolutely unfair.
Of course,
look,
it's not fair.
I know they've had their own challenges, but the poor old FFA, they can't be in charge of the English Premier League teams as well as the A-League teams. That's not unacceptable. Yeah. Unacceptable. So the FA did a good job there. In fairness, I reckon, considering what was going on in the background, I've read a bit about this story, with that Saudi conglomerate bid to take over Newcastle United. They did their due diligence pretty well, and they were unhappy with how it was all looking, and they've made the call on that. So I think whilst it's unpopular with Newcastle fans, in the end, it's probably the right outcome for the game, for the sport over there as well. And there's a lot of elements of to that, not just from a football perspective, but a human rights perspective and all that sort of thing. So I think there's more to that decision than just football, from that conglomerate's end, or certainly from the FA's end, and they've knocked it on the head. But you're right, it does take away the opportunity, because with that would have come billions. And billions is a lot.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But you can understand the disappointment of the Newcastle fans. It's almost like a situation where you're going to get lots of money in a will or something like that, and at the last moment it gets taken away. You know, you start dreaming of all the things that are going to happen, and then all of a sudden you get the late call. Yeah, that's fallen through. Sorry about that.
There's got to be another scenario you could paint. There's just got to be.
Well, it is. You can see that happening. Where you go, I could get that. I could get that. Yeah, I could probably get that, and then you just get the phone call. Nah, it's off the table. It's fallen through.
It was a business deal. It's a business deal. Let's do that rather than the will. Let's change the scenario. Business deal. You banked on conglomerate's going to come in and buy you out. So you've bought the Ferrari in your head. You've got the place on the cliff top, and then all of a sudden they pull out. Oh, sorry, we've changed strategy. It's like when Chris Connolly said to me when he was coaching Fremantle, "I got you a 4-year deal. Come over. Start looking for real estate." And this is exciting. End of my Hawthorn days. Oh, this is exciting, Beck. What do you reckon? We'll go to Perth for a couple of years. That'd be good fun. Yeah, let's do that. Started looking for houses, and then he rings me back one day. Oh, we've changed strategy. We can't have anyone over 26. Well, that's unhelpful, Chris. That's unhelpful. Very unhelpful. I could have been a Doig medalist.
Yeah, you could have been. You could have been.
Could have been a Glendinning medalist.
Could have been part of the Purple Haze.
Could have been all over the anchor. I could have carried an anchor. In fact, that's what I was doing most of my career with my bloody legs. Well, let's get to Craig Gabriel, who's covering the US Open for us. We know that he's a mate of Hugh Grant. Now, if he's a mate of Hughie, chances are he's a mate of Cole. Or Cole Dog, as I'm sure he calls him. Craig, good morning.
No, I don't call him Cole Dog. It's a Collie.
Collie.
Or Collie or Firthy.
Collie or Firthy, right.
Yeah.
Of course you would. How old's your mate Firthy today, Craig?
Well, just remember that they're behind time-wise, so his birthday would actually be tomorrow.
Don't get bogged down in detail.
He's still 59, but tomorrow, when it is his birthday in Europe, he'll be 60.
Oh, correct. Oh,
Spot on. I knew you'd be good mates with him. I knew it'd be in the diary.
I mean, I'm surprised that he hasn't had a credit for Love Actually, because he played the writer in that one, remember? And
he did.
Falls in love with the Portuguese waitress.
Well, who hasn't done that?
Yes.
Agabe Meharusil type, Craig.
Yeah. And who had the chubby sister who told the sister, yeah, take him and then you can get Prince Harry. Remember that? And there were no eels in the pond that they had to jump into.
Even when the tennis is over, Craig, I'm going to call you every morning just to do this bit. Our Outstanding work by you. Outstanding. So, further, he's 60 today, or tomorrow, England time, whatever you like to say. But anyway, he's having a great time, and you win today's Battle of the Ages. Well done. Well done to you. Now, what's happening on court? Because Serena was out earlier this morning, wasn't she, in the quarterfinals?
Yeah, look, she had a tough one, and this is her third three-setter in a row. She ended up beating Svetlana Pironkova, but Sveta played a pretty good match. I mean, she and I are friends as well, so it's Piro or Sveta. But Pironkova was up a set in a break. She broke in the first game of the second set, and Serena really had to work pretty hard to get back into the match, and it was 4-6, 6-3, 6-2. Yeah, she's just finished her post-match media conference, and I actually asked her, I said, the first game of the third set, Pironkova was serving that and went back and forth on the advantage and the deuce and all that. And I said, you know, how important was that? And she said, yes, that certainly was one of the important parts of the match, because it was better for her to be serving at 5-2 up and then close out the match rather than being at 4-5 or something like that. So, you know, it was a solid effort. She really had to work hard in that one. And as she said, what I've been saying, it doesn't matter how you start, it's how you finish. And that's exactly the way it is.
Well, that is true. That is true. Is she looking sharp enough, though, Serena? Is she sharp enough? Because, as you said, a couple of three setters in a row, and she's had to find her groove late in games to get it done. Is she sharp enough to win it?
Yeah, look, she's the, you know, we all know what she's capable of, and she will lift with every match and produce the goods where she extra goods where she really has to. It wasn't a great match from her, and she's certainly going to have to lift her level markedly. You know, the next round, we don't know who she's playing in the semifinals as yet. It's either Victoria Azarenka or Elise Mertens. And if it is Azarenka, it'll be the second match in a row that she's playing a fellow mother. And that has not happened in the open era, certainly, of women's tennis. So we'll see what happens there, but she's going to have to lift her game in that. Azarenka's playing pretty well. She won the Cincinnati tournament, even though it was a walkover for the final against Naomi Osaka. And Elise Mertens is very capable. I think she and Elise have played once, and she beat Mertens on that occasion. But, she does need to lift the level, but I would expect her to anyway at this end.
Craig, just one final one on Serena. The fact that she isn't necessarily at her best. Now, in the past, when she's done full preparation going into slams late in her career, she gets nervous because of the history attached to the next win and all that sort of stuff. And she says it doesn't, but it clearly plays on her mind. Is it the same this time round, or is it more just the rust because she just hasn't been playing competitive matches recently?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more of the latter. And funny enough, I have not heard the number 24 mentioned once.
Okay.
You know, this tournament, and I think I've been listening throughout her in all her media conferences, but it hasn't been raised once by anybody. Whether people in America have been told, do not dare talk about this.
Yeah, that's
yet.
Right.
otherwise, she'll never speak to you again. But I think it is just a matter of you know, being a little bit rusty on occasions. But again, it doesn't really matter. You do whatever you have to do to win, and if you've got a W at the end of your name after the match, that's all. It doesn't matter if you play a shocker and get through 7-6 in the third, or you play a blinder and it's love and love, or you're playing absolute junk tennis and you win. That's all you need is the win.
Phil Rockner's got the latest for us. Hello, Phil.
Good morning, fellas.
Now, Phil, speaking of yellow, who's in it at the moment in the tour?
Yeah, look, it's still our boy Primoz Roglic who runs the tour. Last two stages, boys, have been pretty flat. So the big hitters have put their swords away and have just survived. You know what it's like when you get 160 dudes all wanting to be in the same spot at the same time. It can get quite hectic. Yeah. Last night's stage win was the Aussie, of course, Callum Ewan, getting another victory. He was supreme for a number of reasons. A, he did it without a lead-out train. He had the boys who worked for him, but then he just finds a way to find the gap to get to the finish line. He really is quite clever on a bike, and he's very fearless. And he was, again, the fastest guy. Quick enough, boys, that he could turn around and give the one finger. Now, I mean the pointer finger salute to the crowd while he was getting across the line. That's how quick he is. He had that much of a gap, which in sprinting terms is an eternity. So he's done a very nice job.
Well, you tipped that, I reckon, with us on Monday, that you, Caleb Ewan, to get another stage win in the next little bit. So well done to you. You took out the 11th stage, our man, the Aussie, from Australian perspective. Anyway, what about Peter Sagan? Did he get sort of banished to the back of the field for being a loose dude?
Yes, he bumped shoulders in the finale. And Peter Sagan, the man who likes to make a party, he was not making party. He was getting relegated. He's in a bit of strife at the moment. He's had the last 7 green jerseys all to himself. I mean, he's just got a lock on it. But this year, Sam Bennett, the Irishman, is doing a very nice job. He's 60-something points ahead of him. And the way the point structure is, it's going to be hard for him to get that back. So that relegation was massive for his chances of grabbing an 8th green jersey. But let's be honest, he's had a fair lock on it. Nice to see someone else having a swing in green. But the relegation, boys, if you veer off your line just like, you know, any other sports in that situation, you do get bumped back.
Well, we had an incident. What was that? That race not long ago where we had that horrible accident with someone getting offline in the sprint to the finish.
That's right. In one of the early lead-up races too. It was.
Yeah.
And look, these guys, if you think about what these guys are doing, they're racing at 60, 70 k's an hour at 1,000 watts with, you know, lactic acid screaming through their minds. It's hard to keep that line. And when they do come down, they've got Lycra and a bit of plastic on their head that protects them. It's insanely brave of these boys and how quick they go.
Crazy, crazy stuff. Now, tell us about the COVID situation, because on the weekend, Christian Prudhomme tested positive, which was quite bizarre because not only could it affect the tour, but it might affect the Prime Minister because he was hanging out with him in the car for a couple of days as well, I believe.
Yeah, this is 2020, right? So Christian Prudhomme is the guy who runs the race. He's the race director. You'll see him, you would have seen him, and you might not know, but you'll have seen him in that red car that follows the race around. What he generally does in that red car, he has dignitaries in there and he has wealthy sponsors in there and that sort of stuff. We're never going to get a shot in the red car. But at the moment, you don't want to be in there because he tested positive on the rest day 3 days ago and has been sent home. The Prime Minister was in the car as well during stage 6, he might have been in there. So he's obviously in quarantine as well or in doubt. 4 teams have had positives with their service support people. Ineos, which obviously has the Tour de France favourite in Bernal, Mitchelton, the Aussie team, Cofidis and AG2R have all got one positive away from being expelled from the Tour, which is massive news as well when you think about the fact that Ineos has the potential race winner and has had the race winner for the last 400 years. This is a team that could be leaving the Tour if they get another positive. So it's very, very, knife edge for those guys. I will rest say, too, that Prudhomme, the race director, he wasn't part of the bubble. So he doesn't interact with the riders, per se, on a after-race basis. So he's not part of that. So hopefully the riders have avoided that. But it's the whole race, boys, is seriously on a knife edge, given the way France is getting so many positive tests at the moment. It really is frightening for those who are on it.
It's simmering. The siren has sounded, lads, but it's simmering. Still feeling in this. Corbett misses, and that encapsulates the night for the Suns. The Brisbane Lions peel off 5 straight wins. They soar into second spot on the ladder.
My word, they do. Everyone loves a Q clash, none more than Kelly Underwood there on Fox Footy last night. She was calling with Brad Johnson, who saw the Brisbane Lions defeat the Gold Coast Suns by 45 points with a little bit of tension meld through the evening as well. Jono, good morning to you.
Good morning, Harv. Good morning, Whitey. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, it was a good clash last night. The Brisbane Lions just were pretty dominant from the outset, to be honest. They were pretty powerful. The way they moved the ball was very good. Gold Coast just could not get into it at all. So in the second half, I think they just tried to get a little bit more physical, the Gold Coast Suns, and turn it into a bit of a scrap more than anything, but Brisbane were very good across the entire night.
So it pretty much locks them into a top 2 finish, doesn't it? The Lions, what they've got to come and what they've been able to do. Who they got on the way home, Jono? They've got Sydney and Carlton. You reckon they win one of those?
So they should lock him into a top two.
Yeah, and their percentage got a massive boost last night as well, Half, which we all know it's, you know, the fight for the top four is still wide open, and so is the fight for, you know, probably position 7 and 8 or even 6, 7 and 8. And it's going to come down to percentage in the end. There will be some sides that will be on equal points, and double chance could come down to how healthy your percentage is in top eight as well. So it was a big boost for the Brisbane Lions last night. And the thing about the next 2 weeks with them is they probably will win those games, but it'll be a lot more competitive than what they got last night against the Gold Coast Suns. The Swans are looking to finish strong. They're playing pretty good footy. And the Blues as well. And we know they'll compete hard around the ball. So it'll be a great lead-in for the Brisbane Lions against those two teams.
You made the comment last night on the coverage, Jono, about Brisbane just looking that little bit fresher. We spoke to Lachie Neal last week on the program, and he conceded that they'd gone a bit flat in the games, particularly against St Kilda and North Melbourne. But whether it was Charlie Cameron, who looked as good as he's looked in 5 or 6 weeks, but players like Hugh McCluggage, they just looked like they were running on top of the ground a little bit more. Did you feel that was the case, not just in one or two players, but collectively?
Oh, look, across the board, what are you exactly? You're spot on there. And even Lachie Neal post-game, when he was interviewed, he spoke about his own self-assessment, that he'd gone away from hunting the ball, and that was his whole goal for the game last night, was just get back hunting the ball and getting some energy around the contest. So he provided that, had an unbelievable game. Even when Miller went to him in the second half, he still, you know, managed to rack up about 15 disposals in the half and have a huge say. Eric Hipwood was probably had the biggest impact last night, I think, as the Brisbane Lions player. He was excellent. He led up really well, took 4 or 5 marks in the first quarter, got his game going, took Collins out of his comfort zone, got him a bit higher up the ground. And that really helped the way that Brisbane were able to connect from D50 right through. So Eric Hipwood had an excellent game. You mentioned McCluggage, and Cameron was a bit of a spark. And Payne coming into the side to replace Harris Andrews as well showed that he's going to be able to match the biggest type of bigger type players from the opposition over the next few weeks. And he took 4 or 5 intercept marks in the first quarter on King. So he started the game well. He made a few errors as fatigue came into it, but he'll show that if Harris Andrews comes back, that those two may be a pretty good combination, allow Darcy Gardner to play on a better opponent.
All right, I've got 3 questions for you from last night's game. First one on Eric Hipwood and his goal kicking. When does it become a real problem for Chris Fagan and for the team, considering we're about to go into a final series where bad goal kicking cost Brisbane potentially that first final against Richmond, and it's been a bit of an issue all year? Do they try and address it, or they may have already addressed it, or does that become more of a head issue for Eric if they spend too much time emphasising it?
Oh, look, no, they need to emphasise it. It's as simple as that, because you're right. It's going to cost them in a final. They made some errors again last night, even Cam Rayner with that snap from the goal square. You know, like that was just something. He just needed to go back, have the set shot, give his team 30 seconds to actually have a rest as well, kick the goal. There's another minute. Players don't realise that as much. You know, they make these decisions to snap around the corner. If he goes back and just takes his time, it actually helps the team to recover, and some of his teammates to recover as well if he just kicks the goal. So there was that. But, yeah, Eric Hipwood, I'd love to actually know how much work he is doing in terms of goal kicking per week. I'd love to know how many shots he is getting in. I know it's a bit difficult at the moment with the congestion and the frenzy that's going on, but outside of that, you know, Matty Lloyd was one of the best goal kickers of all time, but spent so much time on his craft. Like every session, every single session, hundreds of kicks. And I don't know how much time is being put into that consistently at the moment. I'd love to know that from a Hipwood point of view or a Hugh McCluggage point of view, who's kicked a truckload of points this year. And if it happens in a final, it could be the difference between winning and losing.
Eric Hipwood's goal kicking technique is horrendous. Mm. His body is all over the shop. He's got different angles, and every part of his body, it's going at a different angle. There's no chance of him having any confidence in that ball going straight from what I can see.
Yeah, I agree, Harvin. We've done a lot of work the last few years with just a small terminology that we come up with plant with purpose. So we've been working a lot on the plant foot at the moment. And the plant foot's really interesting, because when you're sort of in general play, you think of when you go kick the ball, you plant really hard because you've either got a bit of pressure around you, you hit the ground hard. When guys kick the goal, they actually relax and they plant really softly. And when you plant softly, the angle of your foot's not correct and your hips will follow that. these guys really have to start working on that plant foot, I think, in terms of planting with purpose. If you do that, then you're going to create the strength required. You can still come in with a slower approach and do all that. But your last few steps, then you plant with some strength. If you plant with strength, especially under fatigue, you're likely to get through the ball a lot better. But if you plant relaxed, you're going to kick relaxed. And they're not making the distance. They're kicking them left and right. So it's a really simple technique that I worked on for a very long time throughout my career, and it certainly works.
Oh, I'm with you on that. Right. And interestingly, Jono, you talk about distance. It's one of the challenges in the women's game that I deal with my Carlton girls, that they often plant lightly. And that we've talked about that. I haven't used that term plant with purpose, but I might do it now. But the plant leg is so important. The weight's got to be put through your plant leg so you can get your hips, your other kicking hip, or the side you're kicking with, through the ball really effectively with power. And that's what we've been trying to work on too. I reckon it's a really good call. Plant with purpose. I like that.
Yeah, plant with purpose and you'll get the strength required to at least kick through it. And the good thing with the plant foot too, it determines your hips. So if you plant straight, your hips are going to follow straight. Even if you're off a little bit of an angle, your hips will follow that angle. So it's really important. It's a really good focus, especially for those that are developing in the game.
I know my two young boys will be doing this morning a two-hour session, plant with purpose. I think you've covered the other one, which was the Cam Rayner miss. But I think the interesting thing with Hipwood was that he had really positive body language last night. He was really jumping for his marks with purpose. I just wonder if he kicked well, just how much more that would elevate the rest of his game to have that confidence to fly consistently for his marks. The other one I want to ask you about was Isaac Rankin. Isaac Rankin did some crazy things last night, some really impressive things, but some horrendous, horrific things as well. That one where he leapfrogged his opponent and all those sorts of things, and a couple of pretty interesting moments over his head.
What did he do then?
Well, he sort of just didn't really go up with any sort of conviction to a high ball. Which is what I did on a regular basis, so I'm not going to be criticising him for it. But what do you... I mean, has he got to the point where he needs to be pulled into line, or do you keep him going because of the magic he can create?
No, he can offer more in-game by getting the basic skills right. I think that's evident. I think everyone can see that. Everyone wants to see the flair of Isaac Rankin, and that is part and parcel of why Gold Coast Suns supporters and we will tune onto the box and go to games to watch him play, because of that magic that we will see on a regular basis. That needs to be a part of his game. But there's aspects of it that, and I think that that Kingy was putting across last night as well, in that just when he's got the basic handball to hit, you don't need to dodge and weave, just hit it and move on. Gary Ablett's the best player in the competition and has been for a long, long time, because he gets the basics right every time. He sees the 20-metre kick, he hits the 20-metre kick, and then he moves on to get the next thing and work on his game. But we still see the flair of Gary Ablett and the dodge and the weave at the times and the magic come in. And I think that's a great example for an Isaac Rankin to go, the best player that we've seen, that I've certainly seen through the modern time, does the basics unbelievably well. But we still see the best of the flair. And Rodney Eade had a really great philosophy in terms of building your base. So we worked on the triangle theory, where you got the base, the strongest part of the triangle, and at the point was your flair. And he still wanted flair in our game. And it was a big part of the way that he coached us as a group. But it didn't hold up your performance. So it would come in every now and then when you just needed to, and a natural thing would kick in. So I think that's something that that Stuart Dew will work with Isaac on, in terms of creating a really good base to his game and creating that work rate and the basics and all that sort of stuff. The flair's there, but you don't tip that triangle upside down and have the flair as your base, because that's, you're not going to survive that way. You're going to be put yourself under too much criticism. So it's quite a simple theory, and I think it'll work well. We still want to see the flair, but he still needs to get other aspects of his game right so he has a more rounded performance.
Let's check in with Shane Crawford. What a man! The 1999 Brownlow medalist, champion of the Hawks, and these days just dominating proceedings in the world of racing with the Tab as well, doing great things. Crawford, good morning.
Hey, Daniel. Great to speak to you. Adam, nice to speak to you. Hope you're going well.
We are going well. How are you coping with four mad kids at your house?
You want the honest answer? Not well.
Yeah, I want the honest answer.
Trying times, but you know what? What do? You just got to try and charge ahead. So I'm looking forward to
better weather and hopefully getting outside a bit more in the upcoming months. But I am hurting not being able to obviously go along to the races and hang out with your friends and have a good time. So that hurts, and obviously the football as well.
Well, I want to talk to footy with you a little bit later on, but tell me more about this this racing league you're involved in, Crawf, and what the punters can get involved in out there in RSN land that would be lapping this opportunity up. Tell me more.
Mate, this is right up your alley, Harford. Don't you worry about that. No, it is, because, you know, obviously being involved in horse racing, it's a great thing. It's something I've always done. I love it. But, you know, this is an affordable way for people to get themselves involved. You put in $200. You become a part of a racing league, but you get 6 premium race horses. So there'll be 2 tried horses, so they'll be ready to go. So you hit the track straight away, and then you get 4 yearlings. You've got a budget of $2 million, so you're on average about $330,000 a horse.
Wow.
Which went for $220,000. So all it is $200, and you're a part of a racing league where we take on New South Wales with Laurie Daly. We take on Billy Slater with Queensland. The Victorian team, unfortunately, have to deal with me, but we're the Vic Hustlers after Weekend Hustler. So,
TRL.net,
check it out. There's a video on there. It goes for about 30 seconds. It'll explain it all, and people are going to love it. So you virtually become the owner. You have a decision on the sales. You have a decision on the trainers. The trainers have to pitch to train your horse, and it's the first racing league ever in the world to be done, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
So I get 6 horses, do I, for $200? Is that what you're saying?
You get 6 horses, and not just 6 horses that are not very well bred. These horses are going to be beautifully bred, and you have every chance of them hopefully not only winning a race, but maybe a group race, or possibly winning, as we all dream, the Cox Plate or the Melbourne Cup or one of the great races. But, you know, on the back of that, there's, you know, events and functions. It's just going to be like a huge theme. But the thing is, you own and become a decision maker, so you're always involved in the process, which, you know, it's new, it's a cheap way, and especially for Victorians right now, we've done it bloody tough, but it's been pretty bloody hard. So you need something to look forward to. It's not going to break the bank, and it's a thing you can do with all your family and friends and sporting clubs and mates, and it's nice to be a part of it. Mate, there's only a matter of time before Daniel Harford jumps on board.
A matter of time. Right. I'm all over this.
Hey,
I'm a Leviathan.
Hey, Crawf, you've been involved in horse racing for a long time and ownership. I mean, I guess it's one of those things for only $200. It's a great sort of introduction for people into horse racing ownership as well.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about it is for a long time, a lot of people think, oh, it's just not possible and I just can't get there, whereas this gives them a great opportunity to get involved. So it's great for racing. It's going to introduce new owners, you know, and give them a bit of a snapshot of what it's all about and hopefully a great time. And, you know, racing's done such a wonderful job during, 2020. They've been a real leader in everything they've done. And, you know, I think a lot of people at home, they've been watching the races, even if they haven't had a strong interest in it. So this is certainly going to help in many different forms. And the more owners we can get in horse racing, the better, because it's a great industry. I love it. I love everything about it, the social interaction, you know, backing a winner, you know, the sales. It's just a, you know, good people, real people, and that's what it's all about.
Now, one of the great things about being involved in a team, Crawf, is the end-of-season trip. Is there an end-of-season in the racing league trip?
Well, absolutely, yeah. There's plenty of trips planned. I know the Kentucky Derby was just on, and I was reminiscing because I went there last year and got to witness things like that. But, that's certainly the plan, you know, whether it be from the picnic events all the way up to the Kentucky Derby. Don't you worry. We need to get out of this country. We need to get some things happening on the agenda, and that's certainly, definitely high on the list.
It's a very good point. We know that you excel in those periods of the season as well. So we're looking forward to that. TRL.net is where you need to go to find out more about the racing league and get yourself interested or register your interest on the website. And for $200, 6 horses, premium horses too. That's a great system. That is Crawf. And you get to hang out with one of the all-time greats in Shane Crawf. Now, Crawf, the Hawks. What are we doing at the Hawks, Shane? Are we rebuilding?
We're picking another side to support for the next few years. No, well, this year coming into the season, they were very hopeful. Like, they really
consider themselves a contender. So it's been a huge fail year for the Hawks. Like, start of the year, we were 3-1. But, you know, we're homesick. The MCG, we need the MCG because we don't have leg speed, so we need to move the ball by hand or foot nice and quick, and we need a bit of space. But, yeah, it's been a very disappointing year. But I know Alistair Clarkson's an angry little man, and he hates losing. And there's no way that he's going to try and sit down on the bottom for a year or two and then work his way back up. So it'll be an interesting off-season. A lot of decisions need to be made on a lot of great senior players, and they've been great. But like in horse racing, you know, when a horse gets a little bit older and just can't sort of perform where you need it to, sometimes you've got to make the hard calls, and it's going to be, yeah, that'll Hawthorn will be certainly one club that everyone will be focusing on in what they do and how they go about rejuvenating the list. But you look at Gold Coast, you know, you can see nothing but blue sky, you know, with sides like that. And then you've got, obviously, the Giants and the Demons, who you get extremely frustrated with, mainly from a work point of view, a work ethic point of view. So, yeah, it's interesting times in the AFL world. Loving it because it's a bit unpredictable. But, you know, that's why we love AFL football. It's a good game.
Let's talk some cricket on the Breakfast Club. Great to have Pete Hanscom with us, Victorian cricketer, Australian cricketer, and these days in the Big Bash, Hobart Hurricanes cricketer. What the hell has happened? Pete, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How are we?
We're going well, mate. We're going well, although we'd be better if you were playing in Victoria a bit more through the Big Bash season. What's happened, Pete?
Yeah. But I had to make a move, mate. It's unfortunate, but... Yeah, I think, you know, I love my time with the Stars, but it's a good opportunity to get in Hobart, play with a bloody good team, and on a pretty good wicket, on a good ground.
Oh, no, I think from an opportunity perspective for you, I think it's a terrific result. But did I read right yesterday that the Stars didn't offer you a contract? Is that correct?
Yeah, that is true. It is unfortunate, but it's also a little bit of the nature of the game. Obviously, there's a salary cap, and you got to stay within it. And you look at the Stars lineup, and it's impressive. It's really, really impressive. You've got Dorian Zampa, Coulton Isles coming through, Dunk Madison, Markin's doing an amazing job as well. So. It's hard to fit everyone in, and, you know, unfortunately, my contract was up, and there just wasn't any more room.
Now, if I was your manager, which I'm clearly not, but if I was, and I'd like to be, I actually think it's the best thing for you, Pete, because so often over the last couple of years, you just didn't have the opportunities, you know, and you'd be sitting there waiting to bat with about 10 balls to go, or you're having to come out in a situation that really didn't necessarily suit the way you play. I guess this is an opportunity for you to get involved where it actually suits you, as opposed to just staying in Victoria for the sake of it.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, that's what my decision was based on as well. I mean, I can go down to Hobart, hopefully bat in the top four, potentially top three, and you know, get as many balls as possible to showcase what I can do in T20 cricket, and hopefully doing that up the top order, you know, can show selectors as well that I'm still playing well and can improve this game at all times.
Yeah. Oh no. I think it's a good get for Hurricanes. The fact that you're captain of Victoria, does it make it awkward that you've had to move away, or as you said, it's just the nature of the BBL and it's not really an issue at all.
No, I don't think it's an issue anymore. The BBL started now 10 years ago. You sort of saw like the Renegades and the Stars. Basically, just Victorian squad split down the middle and separated. But now you're seeing a lot more people move into state for the Big Bash from all over the country. So I think people, you're really starting to see that movement, which is good. And you get guys travelling around, playing with different teams, and you get to see a different side of those guys, which is really nice.
Nice. So what about the Shield season? What do you know about what's happening with the Shield season, Pete?
About as much as you. No. We're tracking along all right. It's looking like, you know, hopefully maybe 5-6 weeks away.
Right.
For us, there's obviously hurdles to jump through if we're trying to get a hub going. So obviously, I think this week could be a big one. I think we're waiting to hear back from the South Australian government to see if everything can happen there and we can get some games before the dash.
Now, 2008 was a long time ago. Why did you know that?
It was 11 years ago, 12 years ago. It's long that long ago, I can't count.
Long time ago. That was the first year that we saw Todd Goldstein play for the North Melbourne Football Club. It was round 15, 2008, where he debuted that big, skinny, tall fellow we didn't know was going to go on and play 250 games plus. That's what it'll be this weekend when he plays that game number 250 for the Kangaroos, and he joins us on the line this morning. Todd, good morning.
G'day, Half. How you going?
Going well, mate. Round 15, 2008, that seems a long time ago, mate.
It feels a long time ago as well. it's been an interesting journey, but I never would have thought on that day that I would have been standing here now about to play the number 250. So it's been an amazing journey.
It has been an amazing journey, and you've been an amazing player. I'm very, very upfront and happy to say that to you on the radio. I'm not trying to embarrass you, but you have been an amazing player for the Kangaroos. You should be very proud of what you've achieved at that footy club. But when you did start, Todd, what were your goals? What did you think that your career might look like?
Oh, look, I was hoping just to stay on the list for more than a couple of years. I had absolutely no expectations. I mean, I remember walking out of my manager, Tom Petroro's office with my parents just after I'd been drafted, and I think my mum sort of looked at me and said, "Oh, you know, I think if you get close to 10 years, I think you've done well." And I think she was not really being serious because I don't think anyone gave me many chances of that. So my wildest of dreams, I wouldn't have thought I'd be still here today.
Because it's an interesting one, Todd. I mean, often, and we joke about it on this program, about the players with the basketball background, but you genuinely did have a basketball background. And you sort of share with us a little bit about, were you late to footy, or did you always play both sports, but basketball was just your preferred sport? What was it like for you in that sort of 2 or 3 years leading up to being an AFL footballer?
Yeah, so my dream was always to go play in the NBA, and that was sort of what my goals were. And footy was that annoying sport that I had to play to appease my school, pretty much, was what it was. I didn't really play much of it growing up. I might have a kick every so often in the park, but I didn't really know how to kick very well. And when I moved to Trinity Grammar in year seven, you had to play a winter sport. They didn't offer basketball. So I had to play footy because I wasn't good at any other sport. I think I played back pocket for the year 7B, and for the next 5 years I proceeded to try and do everything I could to get out of footy. Whether it was injuries, whether it was, you know, at one point my dad asked the deputy headmaster, could I miss a few games to get ready for my state basketball carnival, and I think it probably wasn't the greatest time. He was umpiring at half time of a footy match. That didn't go down too well. He said I could leave the school if I wanted. I was pushed a lot by Trinity to keep pursuing footy and Rowan Brown now. So I'm very, very thankful for him for encouraging me to keep playing footy. And when I got to year 12, I really started to enjoy it. And that's probably when I started to think, you know, would I like to keep playing footy?
Well, there you go. That genuinely is basketball background type of activity because, you know, you were sort of going down that pathway with the Ngunnawal Inspectors and, you know, it was pretty serious stuff, your basketball. So with your footy, Todd, you are quite a natural footballer. And I'd say at times you're almost like an additional midfielder for North Melbourne. So where did that natural understanding of the game come from if you didn't really love playing growing up?
I think if you had watched me early on, you wouldn't have said there was a natural gift to footy. It's something I've learned and I've built on from the time I got drafted. I watched someone like Dean Cox, who was at the peak of his powers when I got drafted, and I saw how he moved, and the work that our fitness staff, Paul Turk and John Siegel, did with me in my first sort of 3 or 4 years to build up that fitness base to be able to move was something that's really been advantageous to me. And I think the rest of it, it's just been learning on the job. Watching what others do, trying to find ways that I can play to my strengths and try and bring them to the fore rather than relying on just the same sort of stereotypes that you expect from a ruckman.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So who are the ones that at the club that you work with really closely, or players, that teammates that you work with that help you hone that craft, not just watching Dean Cox or living it yourself, but getting some guidance through who?
Yeah, I think Dave Hale and Hamish McIntosh, my first few years. I mean, Hamish was someone that liked to get a bit more of the footy than I did in those days. So he was definitely someone that I watched very closely. And working with our midfield coaches over the journey, with Darren Crocker, Jared Moore, currently Jade Rawlins this year. So I've had a number of different coaches as well that have really just tried to help me focus on see what I'm good at and how to utilise those strengths.
Well, they've done a good job because you utilise them pretty well. And you've been through a few cycles with the Kangaroos. You had those years in 2014 and 15, I think they might have been, with the prelims, so close to a grand final, and then back down sort of the other end of the table at the moment. Now, have you enjoyed the roller coaster ride of AFL footy through all these years?
Oh, look, it's the sport you love to hate. It's very frustrating at times, but I think that those highs that we reached in 2014 and 2015, we didn't quite get there, but those highs is what pushed me, and it's the thing I want to experience again is final footy and some success in finals footy. So that's the driving motivation, and all these periods of time where we're not quite where we want to be is just making me more motivated to want to get back up there, and I think that's how I've been looking at it.
Can't get enough of the Melbourne Rebels either, and they are into the finals of a, albeit shortened, Super Rugby season, but it's the first finals campaign in 10 years. Jordan Ulisi from the Rebels joins us. Jordan, good morning.
Morning, good morning. How are you?
Mate, we're going very well, thank you, buddy. Appreciate you coming on. And boy, oh boy, there was some drama last week to get into the finals. That game against the Force, you must have no fingernails left.
Oh, mate, definitely. I thought, I was on the sideline and really went down to the wire there. So, definitely brought us another week, and the heart rate's still coming down now. So, very excited to be in the finals this week.
So for those playing at home, you needed the win by 4 and you, to get into the third spot for the playoff. And you defeat Matt Tamua, kicked a conversion after the siren to get that 4-point victory, 34-30. So it all came down to that Matt Tamua kick.
Yeah. Yeah, well, fortunately for Matt, the trial was under the post and he just had to kick it from right in front. So it was probably good for him and his nerves, and probably good for our nerves as well. So, we were down by three. Scored a last-minute try and hit a 2 points, get conversion. Yeah. Now we're in the finals and, definitely making Victoria proud and making our first finals appearance for the Rebels.
It's fantastic to see the Rebels doing so well this year. Obviously, it's under unique circumstances and certainly not what anyone planned. But how enjoyable has the season been for you guys because the fact you're winning?
Everyone loves a winning side. Definitely brings smiles to the boys' faces. Obviously, we've been on the road for the past 11 weeks, stuck up here in Terrigal, New South Wales, playing all our home games in Sydney. So definitely backs against the wall, but I guess that's when the team comes together and really gels well together. So, definitely enjoy winning. And we bought ourselves another week and another tough battle up in Brisbane, which we're looking forward to.
Are you a significantly better team this year than last year when it was the normal Super Rugby season, or is this more that the opportunity has presented itself because there aren't as many teams to play against, particularly those New Zealand teams that are always really strong?
Yeah, no, look, I think we're a building side. Our squad isn't too different from last year. I mean,
before COVID hit, we had a win against the Highlanders in New Zealand, and we had a win against a strong South African side, the Lions. So, you know, we're definitely a building side, and we're definitely a young one. So we've, over the past few years, we've been building, and really the young fellas have really grown into their own skin. So I don't think our team's, I don't think our sides are too different, but yeah, definitely the time we've had together and I guess our own little bubble here in New South Wales really has helped build combinations and really have helped us gel as a team, and that's obviously paying dividends on the field.
Now, it's prelim final this weekend. For those playing at home, it's the Brumbies have gone through to the grand final. That's next Saturday, I believe. And the prelim is this weekend between the Rebels and the Reds. Now, the Reds have caused us a little bit of trouble this year, Jordan. We drew the first time, 18-all, and then they did a bit of a number on us, 19-3, a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago. How do we turn those tables?
Well, I think the last time we played Brisbane, the Reds up in Brisbane, we had a 2.5 bus ride down to Sydney Airport, then jumped on a flight up to Suncorp Stadium and had to wait around for 2 hours. So hopefully we can fix those travel, I guess, ramifications where, you know, we don't have that obstacle to cross. But, yeah, the Reds are definitely the informed team at the moment. And, you know, we have our ways around that. Definitely our forward pack has been working hard on our set piece this week, and our back line have been, you know, trying to work at scoring opportunities because they are a very good defensive side, and in saying so, we've got our own threats, and I think we head down to Sydney on Friday, so we just jump straight in the plane, get out to Brisbane, and you know, hopefully that helps the boys get up for the game.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.